Well, we'll go ahead and get started. And as people join us, that's great. We'll just welcome them as they come in. But otherwise, I want to introduce to you our speaker tonight. And this is Pastor Stigmeyer. Everyone can say hi.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Pastor Stigmeyer.
And he is going to, do you know him? Does anyone know him from before? Okay. So he used to be in Fort Wayne at the seminary there and is a professor at Concordia Irvine. So he's going to speak for us tonight, but I'm going to go ahead and open us with an introductory question and then an opening prayer. Maybe Pastor Duncan will join us. And if he does, then he will pray. And if not, either I will or I'll ask one of you. So, because you guys are all experts, I'm sure. All right. So let's go ahead and I have my opening question for you is, first of all, how many of you know of a couple who struggled to have children? How many of you know someone personally? Okay, so we know that this is a very real possibility, right? A reality for many people. For those of you that have said you know someone, for how many of you is it a relative or very close family friend? And how many of you know someone maybe who has investigated or thought about using IVF or other methods, right? Of course, there are lots of things that can cause infertility, that can cause the inability to conceive, and some of those are very easily fixed and some of them are not, right? And so Pastor Stigmeyer is going to be talking to us about some of those issues tonight. Let's go ahead and open with prayer. Is there a volunteer who would like to pray?
All right, please pray with me. Dear God, I thank you for the opportunity to get together and learn more about how we can defend little bitty babies that many people don't even consider that way. Lord, we ask that your hand of protection is upon them as they may be sitting in freezers right now. And we ask that our action may be in your will and may be a witness to our communities. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen. All right. Well, take it away, Pastor Stigmeyer. It's all yours.
All right. You can hear me okay? Everybody's good? Okay. Yeah, I do. So I teach and I teach bioethics to nursing students. I also teach theology, but my main thing is teaching our nursing students. Bioethics has to do more than just with issues of the beginning of life, but also the end of life, as well as all sorts of things in between in terms of different medical technologies that are coming along that deserve to have some ethical evaluation. So that's what we do. And that's what my specialization is in bioethics. So, but I'm not a physician. I'm not a medical doctor. I don't work in the medical field. Mainly, I just look at things from a theological, spiritual, pastoral perspective, and the philosophy of ethics. As Michelle was saying, people do sometimes struggle. Couples sometimes struggle to have children. It's perfectly natural. In fact, it's God-pleasing for men and women, man and wife, to desire children. That is an important part of creation, important part of being in marriage. But it doesn't always happen, and children are a gift. I mean, there's no guarantee. Most of the time it works, but sometimes there are medical reasons why it might not. And sometimes those can be fixed fairly easily, and other times not. And so there are some new technologies, and IVF isn't super new. It's been around since, I mean, they used to call them test tube babies, okay? We don't use that term really anymore, and it really was never a scientific term. It was just what the newspapers used. And I can remember, because I'm that old, in 1978, okay, that was when the first test tube baby was actually born. They had, for many years before that, they'd been working on the technology, trying to develop the technology, but there were a lot of failed attempts. So the first successful pregnancy that went to term, to delivery, was Louise Brown in England in 1978. And I do remember, what I remember is talk on the news, the word test tube baby. And people were really concerned at the time Because it was such because it was a new technology, and it does have ethical questions. Now, some of the ethical questions we might talk about might be a little different than some of the questions they were talking about in 1978. Then people were scared that this was, playing God. That's a common phrase that people use when they're thinking about some of these medical technologies. Are we playing God? Is that dangerous? Oftentimes people will compare this to, say, the Tower of Babel, right? The story in Genesis of the Tower of Babel, where the people were using their know-how and their engineering and their skills to build a tower to God, and God confused their languages because of their arrogance, okay? And so sometimes people kind of make that comparison that we're using science and medicine in ways that might be not God-pleasing, might be usurping God's role. And so people were nervous in the late 70s about what this meant, and would these test tube babies be different in some way? Was their humanity in question in some way? So there was a lot of discussion. Nowadays, you don't really hear that about IVF, like in the media, like in the mainstream media. People aren't it might be about cloning or some other technology down the road that people are kind of talking about in the news. IVF, though, while it has, they've fine-tuned the process over the decades, especially for Christians and for pro-life people, Christian and non-pro-life people, there are some serious concerns with the whole process of in vitro fertilization. But I'm glad that Michelle asked if you knew anybody. Of course, many of you did. Most of you did. I have students, when I teach this, I have students who certainly know people, and students who are, in fact, the results of their parents using in vitro fertilization. So I'm always careful when I talk about this from an ethical perspective, because I don't want to ever imply, and we should never imply, that children who come into this world via the means of in vitro are somehow to be ashamed. Okay, there's nothing for them to be ashamed about for that process, for being the sort of product or results of that process. They shouldn't be ashamed. So I don't ever want to make it sound like, I think that they're monsters or anything like that. And the same will go for other reproductive technologies too. But that's one thing. And the other thing too is, having been a pastor for 15 years, a lot longer, I've been in the ministry, but actually serving in a church for 15 or so years, I've talked to a lot of couples who are Christians, members of the LCMS, who maybe in the past did use IVF or are considering using IVF now. And a lot of times, especially if they did it, some time ago, a lot of times they never really thought of the ethical considerations, because I'm not sure that we talk about it very much in the typical congregation. I mean, we're talking about it, and you might have groups within congregations that, that maybe like an LFL sort of chapter or group, but I don't know that we in congregations sort of in general, like from the pulpit and in Bible classes and confirmation classes, if we talk about it. And you always want to be age appropriate, and you want to be sensitive, especially if you're doing it in the pulpit. You want to be very sensitive that you're not condemning people, specifically for things like this. But in some way, shape, or form, I do think it should be more of a part of the conversation, because people in our churches don't always know what ethical or moral or spiritual issues might come into play until after you talk to them. And then they might say, oh, well, I didn't realize that, or I didn't think about that back then. Or sometimes maybe they did and they just did it anyway. But, of course, we know the grace of God covers a multitude of sins. And so this is not about let's point people out or point fingers at people, but just to try to shed light on this subject so that young people and married people and soon to be married people have a better understanding of all that it entails. All right. So that's kind of my introduction there. So have you guys, you're all in high school? Are any of you, did someone say you're a student at Concordia Chicago? Then most likely you've had sort of a biology class. You've you may have learned some of this terminology. I'm not going to go deep into science, but I think it helps to know a little bit. All right. So my next slide. Okay. So these are just some terms that are relevant for where we're going to go with this discussion. And I'm going to probably spend more time talking about conception than you might expect even. Because pro-life people often will say life begins at conception. And you know, I think that too. And I say that too. Now, it is a little complicated because the definition of conception is not always the same. It kind of depends. So some medical people, like doctors and medical textbooks, sometimes define conception or define pregnancy a little different, or the beginning of pregnancy. Okay, when does pregnancy begin? They don't always give the same answer. Okay, so I'm gonna propose maybe some new ways of talking. So does conception, I think most of us, probably most of us, when we say conception, we probably mean what could also be termed fertilization, right? We're thinking, if we know our biology a little bit, we're thinking of that moment when the sperm and the egg fuse together and a new, entirely new individual life begins at that moment. That's fertilization. And I think we might think that that's conception. And for a lot of people that is, but I just think, so like when I teach my nurses, you know, they will sometimes push me back a little bit and say, well, wait a minute, our textbooks say that that's not when pregnancy begins, at fertilization. Do anyone want to guess what other alternative this? I mean, if pregnancy does not begin from the scientific perspective, if pregnancy doesn't begin at fertilization, at what other point might they point to? Do anybody?
When the embryo attaches to the uterus?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, implantation, which usually happens several days after fertilization. So that is, and that's important because if we start talking about, because some methods of contraception, some methods of birth control address implantation so that even if the zygote exists, there's a, the fertilization occurs, there are a few days before that zygote implants, attaches itself to the lining of the uterine wall. And during those few days, is that a human? Is that a life? Is that a person? Does it deserve protection or not? And so medical textbooks say, well, during those few days, the woman's not pregnant yet. Pregnancy begins like 4 or 5 days later when the zygote attaches to the uterine wall. And so there are some means of birth control that try to prevent implantation. If they don't succeed at preventing fertilization, it will prevent implantation. So, you know, if we believe, okay, as I'm proposing we do, that life begins at fertilization, then it is ethically problematic to intentionally prevent implantation. So some of those methods of birth control might actually be causing the loss of a very new life, okay, human life.
So I'm going to interrupt real quick because we actually did a big thing, a big night on conception and right, those methods, but there were some people that weren't here for that event. And so I just want to pause and make sure that everyone understands that not all birth control methods do this, but there are some that do. And you know, we could spend an entire hour talking about those different types. And we did earlier this summer. And if you'd like to see the link to that, I'd be happy to send it, but if anybody has a quick question, now is a time to ask, because that is a real issue.
Yeah.
Also, if you're not sure about fertilization being the beginning of life, now is the time to ask, because otherwise, that's the foundation for everything he's going to be talking about beforehand.
Yeah, because in vitro fertilization is fertilization. Okay, so what we end up with in the, you might know in vitro, the word is Latin, in vitro means in the glass. So it's like it's a petri dish, not a test tube. It's like a glass dish, science lab dish. And what occurs in there, specifically in the dish, is fertilization. So we have to have clarity on what is in that dish. What is it that's in that dish? Is that a human being as we understand, you know, a person with rights, right to life, okay? Or is that just sort of a pre-human or pre-whatever, and it's not really a human person until it's transferred to the mother and implants itself, okay? So that's why I spent some time on that, because what happens in the dish is actually fertilization. So if fertilization isn't that point of a new life, then you might answer some of these ethical questions differently. All right, so I won't go through all these others, but just to kind of, I just wanted to show you some of these terms, that there are names for these different stages of pre-born life. We usually mostly are familiar with the words embryo and fetus. Okay, so those, I just want to give you those terms. So let me talk a little more specifically about in vitro and the process of in vitro fertilization, as well as some of the concerns and some of the ethical concerns. So there's some medical concerns and personal concerns or relational concerns. And there are also moral concerns, ethical moral concerns. I'm gonna address those in a couple slides. So as I mentioned, the words in vitro mean in the glass, okay? And as I also mentioned before, this first was successful on a human in 1978. So now that's been a little more than what, 40 years. So there are, I don't have the exact number right in front of me, but there are many thousands of Americans and all others around the world, hundreds of thousands, who are children who were born because their parents used in vitro fertilization. So this is, it's becoming more common. Any kind of, unless you're well-versed in pro-life stuff, or you maybe you belong to the Roman Catholic Church, many people, any concerns, moral concerns, for very many people, it's just not on their mind. They're not even thinking of it. So we do have a challenge, and we do have an opportunity to do some gentle but firm education about the meaning of life, the meaning of the beginning of life, and maybe why in vitro is not really the way to go. Okay. So this is the process. Again, I don't want to burden you with a bunch of science here. That's not really my specialty anyway, but I want to give you at least the steps. And forgive me if you guys know this. I don't want to be repetitious, but I just want to make sure it's covered. I want to make sure that you know this. Okay. So I'm going to just give you the bullets here. All right, well, to start off, you need to have human ova, okay, or eggs, and sperm, okay? So you need to have eggs and sperm. These kind of cells are called gametes, and there's more than one way to come across these. Probably most of the time when a couple goes in to have IVF, the gametes, either both or at least one, comes from them. Okay. So what I'm saying is that, you know, the man who wants to be a father and the woman who wants to be the mother, they are the ones who provide the egg and the sperm, or they're the source. But sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes the reason that they're having trouble conceiving naturally is because there is some medical issue, maybe with the woman's ovaries or something with the man. So often in that case, a donor, okay, an egg or sperm from another human, another source, is needed. Okay, that's what my next bullet says. The eggs and or sperm might come from the couple doing the IVF, or they may use donated gametes. And should I talk a moment about this so-called egg donation, sperm donation, or is that something?
What do you guys think? Would you like to know a little bit about that, or yes?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know anything about that, so that would be great.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay, I'll talk about it. Okay, I will. So egg is called donation. All right, that's the term people use. Egg donation for a woman, and then obviously sperm donation for a man. I'm going to focus more on the egg donation issue, but also a lot of the same stuff goes for the sperm too. So So if a man wants to donate his sperm, okay, yeah, he can be paid for this. I mean, there are sperm banks where you can go and donate sperm, and they will pay you. So it's not really necessarily a donation if they pay you. But there's not a lot of money in it for the man, okay? Where the big money can come in is for the woman donating her eggs. And I think probably the money can be a lot bigger because there are more risks. There are not very many health risks to the man for him to make his donation, okay? But for the woman who makes her donation, there are more risks. It's more invasive. And yeah, there can be some complications. It's possible. It's rare, but it's possible. And so because of that, the pay can be a lot higher for a woman, young woman. And where you'll see, so people put out ads. I mean, first of all, there are agencies that look for donors. And there are, you know, agencies that do that. And they will sometimes post ads, often on college campuses, because they want young women. The younger the woman, I mean, you know, like a college age woman, those eggs are going to be more likely to be successful in the IVF process. The whole process of IVF, of leading to pregnancy and hopefully delivery, actually does not have a very high success rate. Even with all the decades of scientific refinements, the success rate of bringing, starting with the gametes all the way to delivery, is the success rate is under 30%. So, you know, the success rate isn't really very good. So, and one of the reasons is because the older the woman is donating the egg, or if it's the mother, the older she is, that can make it harder for this process to succeed. So you really, if you're looking for an outsider, a third person to provide that, you really want ideally a youngish adult woman. And so college campuses are great, especially Ivy League. Okay. So they really, that's where big money is. I mean, if you are a young woman and you go to, say, you know, Princeton, and if you are, well, I've seen these ads, okay, and these ads will often say things like, we want someone who has a certain IQ. They may mention what sort of ethnic or racial background they want. They will even sometimes say things like, you know, musical ability desired. And often, they often will say things like, someone attractive, okay, pretty, beautiful. You know, a lot of these ads, and some of these ads language comes from the couple that desires to use it. And it can be a lot of money. A woman can donate her egg, and it could be 10 grand. Okay. It could be 12 grand. Might not be that high, but it can be. I've seen ads where it is. Okay. So, safely, usually a woman can only do this 6 times. It's not recommended that a woman who wants to donate an egg do it more than 6 times. Okay. So, but if you make 10 or 12 grand each time you do it, and there are no other complications, you know, you can make a good amount of money. And if you're a college student, especially, you might need some of that money for paying tuition and room and board or whatever. So this is kind of there's a lot, that is a lot of ethical complications. Okay, the first thing is quickly here, I'll just say, is that there is some medical risk, some physical risk to the young woman who does the donation. And this is because they give the woman medication, drugs, to stimulate the natural process of ovulation. Okay, so on naturally in a healthy woman, her ovaries produce usually one egg in a monthly cycle. But if you're gonna if you're gonna be harvested, if they're gonna take your eggs, okay, so they will want to try to get more than one, because if there's just one, you know, the success is a lot lower. So they will give you drugs to stimulate the ovaries. Most of the time, there are no complications. But some of the time there are complications, and I don't think I have this word on my slide. I meant to write it down for you. It's ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. Okay. OHSS, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. That is a possible and very dangerous complication. It can result in the woman becoming infertile for the rest of her life. It can even lead to death in the worst case scenarios. So it isn't risk-free to do this, okay? So that is a concern. There's also a concern to make using our bodies and the parts of our bodies, especially those parts that have the special status of procreation, okay, to monetize that, to make it a profit venture. Because if your agencies are being used, they're certainly in it for the money. You know, there may be some altruistic motives too, but they're trying to make money. So that is also very murky, ethically murky. Should we be doing this? Because you can't legally, at least in the United States, you can't legally sell your organs. You know, I don't necessarily need two kidneys. I've got two, but I can survive on one. So why don't I just go to the local doctor and they pay me $25,000 to take one of my kidneys? Because there is a need. There's a need for donated organs. Well, we don't permit that because that is, at least in the United States, because that is considered inappropriate, because some people will be motivated to do that who don't really want to do that, but they need the money. And that's the other thing for these women, because if a young woman is in financial difficulty, she may be sort of pressured in her own mind, maybe, but she'll feel pressure. I need to do this. So what that does is it exploits women who are in financial need. So poorer women are going to be more likely to do things like this, and also surrogacy, which, you know, is another topic. All right. So
of course, college students are in financial need, you know, so that is another reason they are targeted. It's a great place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because of that. And and their youth.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. So with the drugs that stimulate the ovarian process, they can usually retrieve 10 to 20 eggs. Okay. That's the expected. I've heard that 15 is kind of the golden number. If it stimulates it too much and you get too many eggs, I guess the quality isn't as good. So they like it to be between 10 and 20, and that's what they get. Fertilization then occurs in the lab. Okay, so once the egg and the sperm are gathered, then some technician or a doctor will do the magic they do in the laboratory to make the egg and the sperm come together, and they give it certain chemicals to make it a very hospitable environment for that to happen. And fertilization, most of the time, does occur. Some sperm make it to the egg and do what they are designed as living human cells to do. And so fertilization occurs. So now you've got embryos, okay? Now you've got, there's zygotes, but I'll just use the word embryo. Well, now you've got embryos. The status of an embryo from a pro-life perspective is that this is a unique human person's life. This is a unique human being with the right to be protected, okay? And it's a vulnerable, obviously very vulnerable human being that can't do anything for their own sakes. So they are in the lab, in the dish. The next step then, of course, is, they'll test them. They're looking for any genetic issues, any problems. That's the first thing they're looking for. So they do the pre-implantation. Genetic testing is, you know, are there any deformities? Is this going to lead to any genetic diseases, perhaps? And then they screen those out. You know, if one of them has the propensity to have, diabetes or, you know, something maybe like cystic fibrosis, these are genetically related diseases. And so they're not going to implant those. They're going to screen those out. The other thing that genetic testing does, and I think in the future is going to be used more and more for, is finding desirable traits. You're not just trying to find the traits you don't want, like diseases that you could screen out, but you're also looking perhaps for genetic traits that are desirable for you. So if you got 20 embryos and say 11 of them are male and 9 of them are female or vice versa, and you only want a boy, okay? So you are automatically gonna take those. So right now, sex selection is most likely to be the trait people would look for. But as genetic medicine advances, people are gonna be looking at these embryos for more and more traits to hopefully have the child that they choose with the traits and features that they, as parents, choose to have for their children to have. And that is another area that is problematic. It's ethically troubling when you think of parents sort of designing. Now, you know, we're not at the point where we are literally altering the genes to be exactly what we want. That's coming. And we can do that on a limited basis, but they're not supposed to be doing it with human embryos. That's what you get genetically modified foods and animals. So we can do that. Okay, so the pre-implantation genetic testing and screening is already ethically, well, it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. And I would say it's wrong to exclude, well, anyway, yeah, I think you get the point. You don't want to be, we're already in very dangerous territory.
Yeah, real quick, I'm going to pause here. You guys, what do you see as a problem with genetic testing? When we talk about the sanctity of all human life, and we talk about Y for Life wants to serve all those invisible groups of, you know, we've talked about being from invisible to indispensable, right? What do you guys think? What groups would be harmed here?
I was going to say that particularly groups that are affected with disabilities or other you know, like genetic disabilities or intellectual disabilities that are in other countries seen as less worthy or even in our own country. I know that Down syndrome is a really big one, especially now in a lot of countries where there's almost a genocide of individuals who are identified to have Down syndrome before birth, and they're encouraged to be aborted so that they aren't actually born, and therefore they're like cleansing the genetic palette of individuals with that type of disability.
Yeah, I was basically going to say the same thing, that it's like flawed human beings saying, well, you have this physical problem, so you're not really worthy of the same chance that I got, even though I'm really bad at whatever, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it is valuing one set of abilities over another set of abilities, right? And we know that there's no place for that in the kingdom of God. So, great. Okay. All right, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. I mean, that's excellent. I think that's, you guys hit it on the head. If is going to be the Down's kid, right? It's going to be the embryo that has the Down syndrome or other disabilities. Yes, those parents, most of the time, if they're in this process and they're doing this, they are going to opt out of using those embryos. So what happens to them? What's the fate of embryos like that? There's really only maybe three possibilities. They're either going to be just destroyed and discarded, or they might be used in research and then destroyed and discarded, or it's possible that they will be cryopreserved or frozen for some future use. Okay, now with the disability, with an embryo that has something like that, it's more likely to just be destroyed or used in experiments. So the next step in the IVF process is transferring the embryos to the woman's uterus. And they usually take 2 or 3. So if they had 20, and maybe of those 20, let's say 5 of them were discarded for whatever reason, and they can't take the remaining 15 and transfer all those because, I mean, that's not safe. They obviously can't do that. It's usual that not all that. So if they transfer 2 to 3 embryos, you might have one that successfully implants. Now, it is possible for there to be multiples. Okay, so twins or even triplets are not. I mean, so that, you know, there is kind of a rise in the incidence of twins and triplets being born. And part of the reason there's a rise is because of the common use of IVF. So that's possible. So the couple does need to be coached or counseled that that is a possibility. And what would that mean to them? Would they be okay with that? Or would they not be okay with that? Now, if they really just want one baby, but they know the process really needs, it's more successful if they try to transfer two or three. But what if all three implant successfully and they survive, you know, a while and it looks like they're gonna thrive, then, but they don't want three. And yes, with three embryos, fetuses, with three babies, there are risks there. Risks to the woman and risks to the babies. They are more likely to be premature or underweight and other things like that. Okay, now those aren't, there's a lot of healthy twins and triplets. And, but okay, so a lot of times they'll say, no, we don't want that. And so what happens is the doctor may go in and essentially abort one or two of the embryos. They call it selective reduction. It's just a euphemism. They're destroying the nascent life, the new life there. And sometimes they may know that the ones that they take out or abort or terminate are the ones that are girls and they want a boy, or you know, who knows. So the embryo transfer, two or three. Oh, I want to go back. So any questions? Let me just pause. Any questions about the process here? And then if, you know, the rest of the process is pregnancy. Okay. Hopefully, you know, healthy, successful pregnancy that leads to delivery.
I had a question. How do they normally dispose of, like, the defects?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can be as simple as washing them down the drain. It can be as simple as washing them down the drain. Now, I know that they will often want to, like I mentioned, they will often want to experiment on them. And so the experimenting process itself usually destroys them. And then it may just be washed away. I mean, maybe there's another process, but I'm not aware. Does that help?
Yeah.
Sorry, we are going to actually have a segment, another Chats for Life segment on embryo adoption, because again, that's a very difficult question to ask. Now you have all these embryos that are frozen, and in order to possibly try to save them from being used for experiments, there is now an effort to adopt them or find parents that will ask for that implantation. So we are actually going to have that topic in the future. So you'll definitely want to, you know, again, come back for that one. So
yeah, embryo adoption is a thing. So sometimes people will adopt. It's not actually an adoption because legally it's not an adoption because they're not persons legally. It's property. So they're sold. But we do call it adoption, embryo adoption. So a frozen embryo can be sometimes used and transferred to an adopting mother. So that's, yeah, and that has controversy all of its own. So it's good. I'm glad that you guys are going to chat about that in the future. So I want to make sure I get to this. Some of the ethics and concerns, and I've already touched on some of the main ones, but I just want to first, my first category here are concerns, which I'll get to the moral issues. But even if you don't see a moral problem, there are still reasons to be very, you know, concerned about the process, okay, about the whole thing. I'll just give you a couple of those. So you can know some of the downsides, even from a purely non-religious perspective. Okay, first, it's expensive. $10,000 to $15,000 for a single cycle. And a cycle is that the whole process on the last slide is a cycle. And success, the success rate is relatively low. So it's not unusual for a couple to go through two or three cycles. And the expense each time could range around $10,000. So that's already going to mean that the families that are, or the couples that are doing this are, you know, have certain means, okay, probably do. Because insurance, sometimes insurance covers some of it, but I think that's maybe becoming more the case. But a lot of times insurance doesn't really consider infertility or these assisted reproductive technologies as the kind of healthcare that they're going to cover. So insurance isn't necessarily covered. So that's, you know, that's a thing to be concerned about. The other thing is that it's the effectiveness is still not very high, which I've already mentioned. And also I've mentioned this, there are the risks of, you know, multiple pregnancy, two or three. There are, like I said, there are risks to the mother and to the infants, to the children, especially if they opt for terminating one or more of them. Yeah, premature delivery is a little more common with IVF pregnancies. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why there might be premature delivery, premature babies, but IVF does seem to have a higher incidence of premature deliveries. There are other, sometimes you'll hear other things too, like maybe correlation with maybe like ovarian cancer, or you'll hear other correlations, like maybe the IVF children have health problems down the line. And there is evidence of that. There is evidence of that, but I don't know if it's conclusive, but it, you know, that is something to at least study and research before one made this choice. I mentioned this one too, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which can be life-changing or life-ending. And there is the question of unused embryos or spare embryos. And you're going to talk about the embryo adoption, and I've already mentioned what mainly the options are, okay? These are basically the options, okay? So just, and the embryos that are frozen, they can the freezing process often kills them, and the thawing process, if they survive that somehow, the thawing process can kill them or damage them. But sometimes they can be frozen for a long time, you know, years. It's not recommended, but it can be done, and then used later and successfully. Use later. So it brings up all kinds of interesting questions. You know, what if you are in a frozen state for 10 years and then you're transferred to a woman's uterus? So how old are you? I mean, you were conceived at an earlier state. And anyway, so all kinds of questions. And any of these assisted reproductive technologies have the potential, at the very least, have the potential of diminishing human dignity. And I think that's something that Christians need to be better at explaining, okay? Because many times in the world, many times people that are not religiously, you know, Christian or not religious thinkers, even if they are Christian, aren't thinking this through on the basis of their faith, they don't see it though. I mean, they just don't know, they don't see how this could be diminishing or insulting the humanity of these children, okay? Because we tend to be very, Americans tend to be very practical. We tend to be very pragmatic, and we evaluate things on the basis of results, okay? That's often, if it works, it's good. If it doesn't work, it's not good. That is, even if we're not consciously thinking that, that is often what's behind the choices we make. We do what works. And so it is a little hard to explain to people how this can diminish or insult the basic human dignity. Even the term human dignity is difficult to define, but it is still a common enough concept that I think we can use it to talk about what does it mean to be a human being. And what does it say when we are kind of treating our children like projects or products that we're masters of as parents, that we are potential parents, that we have mastery over what kind of children, not only that we have children, but what kind of children we're going to have. That deserves to have a lot more thought paid to. Does that turn the child into, does it objectify the child? Okay. Does it in some way take away the freedom of, you know, of the child, that choices were made for the child, like sex, okay? I mean, what sex was going to be born? If I'd been the other sex, I wouldn't have been born. I mean, do those sorts of questions insult or injure a person's self-esteem, basically, my identity? Another important question that comes up here is the concept of if donor gametes are used, that's almost always anonymous. In other words, the sperm donors and the egg donors almost always want to keep their names secret, okay, anonymous, so that any children that are the result of their gametes don't know who their biological family really is. Now, the agency that harvested the eggs or sperm might have some information that they can pass along, like ethnic background. I mean, aren't we all kind of at least interested in where our ancestors are from? And if you are the product of a donated gamete, you might not immediately be able to tell that. And there might be issues of genetic diseases. Like I said, they try to screen that stuff out. So you shouldn't even be allowed to donate your egg if you have a family history of genetic disease. But nonetheless, children who learn that, eventually, mostly they do, learn that this is how they came into the world. And it doesn't mean that they are less human or that they are less valuable, but it might plant in their mind questions about, you know, who's my dad? You know, I mean, I'd like to know who that is. For some people, that can be troubling to them. And, you know, hopefully this doesn't happen very much, but if there is a lot of anonymous egg and sperm donation going on, it is very possible that you might meet someone that you're related to and neither of you would know. And you might date and you might marry. I mean, this is, I don't know if that happened, how common that is, but this is one thing people are kind of talking about. It is possible that you could meet and marry someone that you're genetically related to through no fault of your own. So these are concerns that anybody, even if they're not, some of these concerns are things that anybody, even if they're not Christians, should be able to understand and maybe agree with you. I guess if I were to say, maybe put everything in a nutshell, I would say I don't really think there is, I don't think IVF is really an option. You know, some people will try to say, well, is there an ethical way to do this? Is there a way to do this so that there are not spare embryos that are frozen or discarded? Is there a way to do this that doesn't diminish the dignity of the humanity of the children? So some people will try to come to that resolution. But I think, you know, right now in general, I think that this is really not an option. It's not just because it's unnatural. It is unnatural. It's not just that, because heart surgery is unnatural, or, you know, organ transplantation is not natural either, but we usually don't object to those things. So being unnatural isn't necessarily the reason by itself to refrain from doing this, but I don't think that it really is an option for the Christian from the moral perspective. It's kind of the bottom line, I suppose, but I tried to give you some context. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just gonna have to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
I actually did a research a lot about IVF and about how it could be possible for a Christian family. And I guess I'd like to share with you, like, what my main points were and what your response would be to why you think that's maybe not okay. Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
So I first of all, I laid out some stipulations. You know, like it has to be to a Christian family. It has to be to a mom, has to be a dad, has to be their gametes. They have to have pure intentions and respect for human life. I also laid out the stipulation that it should be a doctor who also respects human life. Obviously, if you get a doctor who's gonna like be like, yes, yes, and head nod, and then actually go and do something that you asked him not to do, that doesn't work. and then, yep, third party, no surrogate mom, just because that messes with the dignity of the mom and the dad. Mm-hmm. And then also, the respect for the parents, the parents, like you said, like it, the egg retrieval is hard on the mom, but so is pregnancy. So yeah. It's trying to get pregnant in the first place. And then just, of course, respect for the life of the embryos. And the way that I proposed that to be done was not selecting two or three eggs at random and then fertilizing just those. If those aren't fertilized, then those don't need to be protected, and you can use more eggs that were fertilized. And then, of course, insert all the eggs that are fertilized and don't run genetic tests on them. Yeah. And I guess I'd like to hear your response to that.
Yeah. So, it's hard. It can be difficult to say absolutely no to some things, right? So maybe if it's possible to meet all those criteria, then for me, it kind of puts it in a gray area. Is it absolutely completely in every situation? Because you made some very good points. You listed some of the criteria that I would, not the pre-implantation testing, because we don't want to be selecting people out and thus ending their lives because they have a genetic disease or disability. And so you thought of that and you said, well, we don't do that. If there's no spare embryos that get destroyed or cryopreserved, I don't think that's a good idea in itself either. So let's say that there's 10 embryos, because there's 10 ova, right? 10 eggs, and they're fertilized. And so you end up with 10, say healthy, just say 10 healthy embryos, and you transfer three of them to the mother, and one or two implant, and the other one naturally is discarded through her body. Well, now you've got seven, but maybe the parents intend to use those for future children, and so they will then freeze them, but they intend to come back and use them, and maybe that will all work out. And then if there are any leftover or spare embryos, maybe they could be adopted by someone else. I mean, there's a lot of maybes. Is it absolutely impossible ever? I find it hard sometimes to say no. So I don't want to be, I just want to be careful in how I answer the question. I don't want to be an absolute never, but I'm suspicious that it would be, unlikely that that's going to be how people will go, but it's not impossible. Maybe it even is. I mean, maybe people are even doing that. I have heard or read about, let's do it, but let's do it in an ethically responsible way.
Can I ask why you think freezing the embryos is unethical?
Well, I think, I would use the problematic word because, well, first, it's dangerous. You're introducing a danger to their lives that is not ordinarily going to be something they're going to be exposed to. That's not a thing that an embryo would ever face, natural. So it is dangerous, right? It's dangerous to the life and the health of the embryo. They can be damaged or they can be killed for the process. The other thing is there is something, and again, this is one of those things about like human dignity. Would you want to be frozen for 10 years? I wouldn't. I mean, so there's a kind of a golden rule sort of thing here that if we think these are truly, fully human beings, is it respectful to freeze them and leave them in a freezer for undetermined length of time with their fate unknown intentionally. I see that as troubling. Okay, so I would say that being frozen for a period of time is not something most people would agree to do. Does it mean?
What if that means that embryo has a better chance of life? I mean, because there are parents who can, you know, produce a fertilized egg but can't get pregnant. I mean,
right. Yeah, so I mean, certainly freezing them is a better option than destroying them. Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of where I stumble is thinking, can we do this without freezing embryos? Because again, I think that the whole dignity question comes up when we talk about storing someone in a freezer for 10 years. So anyway, I mean, that's probably the best I got. Go ahead.
Is it okay if I add a comment? Yeah. My mom, she was a biochem major. And so out of college, she worked in an IVF blood lab. So like she wasn't combining cells, but she like would do the blood test on the parents to see if they're compatible. And so my dad was like in his first year at the SEM. And so together they were like, yeah, what you're doing, like working there, it's probably not good, even though you're not combining the cells, like it's still not ethical. And so obviously for my parents, like some of their main issues with IVF were all of these things too. But even if I think like personally for me and for my parents, what they were thinking, like even if it's a Christian family and they're using up all the embryos and they're doing it in the best way they can, it's still not how God has designed like for us to be created. Like, you know, like babies are created through a man and a woman, through sex. And when you take them and you make them in a petri dish and then you implant it, then it's more of like humans creating humans, not really God creating us. I don't know. So it kind of takes away.
Yeah, I'm gonna, I was struggling with that same thing when I was writing my speech. But do humans ever have control over what happens? Not really. I mean, they can put them in an environment where they hope things will happen, but they never really have control over whether life is actually being created or not. That, I mean, you know, and, you know, God doesn't create us to be broken. God doesn't create us to be infertile. It's not, I mean, it's not how creation was made.
But there's also women in the Bible that are barren and aren't able to have children. And that's just how God, that's just how they were made. And like, we don't know why they're barren and it's a sad thing, but that's not also like one of those things that is for us to know. It's for God to know and we can ask him when we're in heaven. But like Hannah couldn't have children, or Sarah couldn't have children. Rachel couldn't have children. That's just like three. Or Elizabeth too. She was also one. And so God granted them children, but it wasn't really like humans going in themselves and like being like, okay, let's make her have a baby. I don't know.
Yeah. And I get what you're saying there. And at the same time, like you can say that about any medical procedure, you know, like, why do you have diabetes? You know, like why, you know, it doesn't mean you don't do anything about it. Doesn't mean you don't treat yourself. It doesn't mean you go and find a solution to what's broken. I mean, if your body is broken because something has to be broken because your body is made like to have children, your body's made to have children. And if something's not working, that you're not having children, then you're trying to fix what's broken is the basis of IVF. You know, you're trying to bypass what's broken. And then, you know, that's what medicine is, bypassing what's broken.
I think the difference in IVF is that you're now dealing with new human life. And so you're now taking the risk of ending multiple lives. I mean, I was going to ask this question too. When when women use IVF, aren't there like multiple embryos that are injected into her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. They'll usually do two or three.
So there's always the chance of them dying or like a miscarriage.
Yeah. I mean, it's because if they just did one at a time, the chances of success would be even lower, because for an embryo to implant is not a guarantee thing. So they'd try and usually do two or three, and usually maybe one will. It is possible that two or three would. I have heard of cases where doctors will transfer even more, like four or five, but that's dangerous to the woman. That's usually recommended against. You don't do that. So two or three, there might be three pregnancies. And then if the woman doesn't want all three of them, then they will go in and terminate one or two. So there's all sorts of permutations to this. And I would just say to the conversation that's going on here, the very healthy conversation that's happening, I think we first want to make sure that we are absolutely 100% clear that children who exist because of IVF are not in any way less human or inhuman. I know nobody's saying that, but it is still God who made them. That's all I'm saying. It is still God who made them. God brought life into that situation, even though I don't necessarily think that situation is really the ground we should be going. But God still, if there is a life created, we would say God is the doer of that. But I totally also agree that this is one of those areas where, yeah, I mean, it can definitely be argued that the sexual union of a man and a woman in marriage, the sexual union of a man and a woman in marriage, and then the natural creation of a new life out of that whole process, in a very beautiful, profound way, is part of what it means to image God. So you know how it says in Genesis that man and woman are made in the image and likeness of God? Well, a lot of times Christians have kind of wondered, what exactly does that mean? Doesn't mean we look like God. What exactly does it mean to be in God's image? And one thought that a lot of folks have about that is that, well, you know, God, what is God? God is Trinity. God is a community, you could say this, God as Trinity is a community of loving persons and self-giving persons. And so the family, husband and wife and children, image God in a profound and beautiful way, so that the sexual union is part of that whole one flesh, right? I mean, to be one flesh is a mirror image in a way of the relationship of the persons of the Trinity. Now that is maybe a little speculative, but I think it does merit some attention. And at least for a lot of pro-life Christians, they would say that's why they struggle with dividing the sexual union from procreation, okay? Because in IVF, the procreation happens without the sexual union. So dividing, now that's a bigger topic. I mean, because then we're going to start talking about contraception in general, and you know, that could take us down another path. I think you're onto something, that infertility is traumatic. It is very painful often for couples. But I don't necessarily think that we can just do anything. And I know you're not saying we can just do anything. So I think we can do, there are some possible new treatments that will be less invasive, that might not require the same kind of process, the creation of, if we can come up with maybe another process to, you know, I think we can be a little open-minded about that, but I definitely lean more towards what I was saying, the image of Godness of the family and the procreation of children through that means. And when we separate that and put it in a laboratory, we at least run the risk of of staining the dignity of those children. But I think it's an important conversation. I definitely hear sincere, conscientious Christians who are thinking the way you're thinking, and that maybe this can be done in an ethically responsible way.
And I just wanna, I totally agree. Great points. But also, you know, kind of going back to, I don't know your guys' names, but the comment on what if, you know, the embryos that you intentionally fertilize are miscarried, you know? But that happens in the human body naturally, you know, without us being conscious of it too sometimes. It's not like we're consciously intending these babies to be miscarried. We want them to take, you know, we want them to be implanted, and, you know, God's ultimately in control of that. So.
But I think one of the areas that we probably need to address too is just the first commandment issue, right? And that is that God, you just said it at the end, that God is in control. And sometimes that means that for some reason, we can't have children. And there are some things that we can do to help with that. But we also want to be conscious of, are we trying to play God? Is it a first commandment issue? Are we so set on having to have our own children that we would be willing to do extraordinary means to do that, when maybe the answer is adoption? And maybe the answer is, you know, a simpler one in that regard. So, you know, it's just another angle to think about, that maybe it's okay to say, I haven't been given this gift, and it's very painful that I haven't been given this gift, but there are many things in life that we are not guaranteed. We aren't guaranteed that all of us will live till 80 or 100. We're not guaranteed that all of us will be diabetes free, or, you know, there are so many things that we are not guaranteed, and we're not guaranteed children. It's a wonderful gift when we're given it, but it's not something God says you will have. And that's a hard thing, especially for Americans, to say, I think for any human being, but I think especially in the fierce American independent spirit, to say, wait, I can't have that, but I'm married, right? So it's just another avenue to think about.
I have, I know this doesn't really, I don't know, it's a little different, but you're talking about how, you know, like IVF kind of messes with the union of man and woman. Then how does an adoption mess with the union of man and woman? You know, if we're talking about this process of getting pregnant, what's the difference?
Well, I would answer it this way. Adopting a child is, you know, most likely that child was procreated through the union of a man and woman, unless you're adopting a frozen embryo from an IVF clinic. But that's what you're doing then is you're mostly trying to remedy a situation, you know, making the best of the less than optimal situation, because the option is to let the frozen embryo stagnate forever or die. Embryo adoption has its own ethical questions, and some very well-meaning and pro-life individuals don't think that's the way to go. Others do. Others think that it's you're at least rescuing humans that would otherwise stagnate or die. But on adoption in general, I mean, the Bible does talk a lot about adoption. It talks a lot about taking in the orphan. God doesn't desire anybody to be an orphan, but there are orphans in this fallen world. And so adopting someone into your life is really one of the highest images of the gospel that you can really think of. And it's used frequently in the Bible. We are adopted. We are children, you and I, we are children of God, not by nature, but by adoption. We are grafted in, right? We are brothers and sisters of Jesus himself. And we are co-heirs with Jesus, but it is by an adoptive process. So when we adopt children, we are showing that same grace and mercy of taking in the orphan into our family that God shows to us. So adoption in general, okay, is a very godly and godlike thing to do. And there is a real need for that. I mean, there are a lot of children in the world that languish without a family. So adoption should be, it's another one of those things that we should be talking about a little more as Christians and encouraging that for that people consider that seriously.
Thank you so much, everybody. I'm going to just try and yell so you can hear me. I'll get it fixed by next time. But thank you for joining us tonight. Let's thank Pastor Sigmeier. Well done. Well done. Well done. And hopefully we'll get these slides sent out to you later tonight. Next week, our presentation is going to be on the death penalty. Mm. So please come.
Next week or 2 weeks?
2 weeks next time. Sorry. Thanks for correcting that. Yeah, 2 weeks from now. All right. Any other final questions or comments? I will see you then. If one of you could stay on and help me with my voice, that would be great. But it doesn't have to be all of you. So thank you. See you later.